and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor of the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese of Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide variety of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Ann Japp Jacobson, professor of philosophy at Electrical and Computer Engineering at the University of Houston. Her new book, Keeping the World in Mind, Mental Representations and the Sciences of the Mind, is just out from Palgrave Macmillan. Some theorists and the cognitive scientists have argued that the notion of that minds represent the world gets our relationship to the world wrong, and that the sciences of the mind don't need or use a concept of mental representation. In her new book, Jacobson argues that what is needed is a different kind of theory of what mental representations are, one that reflects the way the notion of representation is actually used in cognitive neuroscience. On her view, mental items do not represent or stand in intentional relations to the world. Instead, they are samples or instances of the same kinds as captured by common mathematical descriptions. This display or sampling model has its roots in Aristotle's theory of perception, but is found in contemporary theories of brain function as well, such as when seeing a particular action causes the neural pattern for doing that action to be activated. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Ann Japp Jacobson.
Hi, Carrie.
Hi, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you, and thank you for asking me to do this interview. I think this is a wonderful project you all are embarked upon, and I'm very, very pleased to be part of it.
Well, I'm happy to be talking with you about your new book, Keeping the World in Mind, Mental Representations and the Sciences of the Mind. And you are giving there a defense of an alternative view of mental representation that on your view, is more appropriate for its uses, or at least some uses, in cognitive neuroscience in particular. So to start off the interview, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what led you to write this book. I mean, and how it connects with your previous work that, you know, is directly connected to this particular book.
Absolutely. Let me say that really I started on this project, but didn't realize it quite some time ago, probably in the 1970s. I, at that time, was in Oxford, and the paradigm of philosophy of mind really was stuff like Kenny's Action, Emotion, and Will, which I found a sort of delightful a collection of intuitions, but not something I myself could undertake. And then Davidson appeared upon the scene, and we had, this is really the late-ish 60s, we had the idea that there are these mental states that are propositional attitudes that enter into causal relations. And my very first thought, actually, on encountering the Davidson program was not particularly positive. I thought that what he was doing was, in effect, inferring ontology off of logical form. I mean, I think that is actually what he was doing. And while I hadn't at that point formulated objections to that, it just doesn't sound to me like a very good way of proceeding. So that was my first big poem about the idea that there are mental representations, that they're realized in the brain, and that they do these causal things. My second thing really came when I finally could no longer avoid doing philosophy of mind, and I was teaching at the University of Houston. I had before that been at Rutgers, and there are too many people who wanted to do the philosophy of mind, but I was needed. They needed somebody to do the philosophy of mind at U of H. So I'm just finding my notes here. So I took it on, and one of the on encountering Crumb, the computational representational understanding of the mind, I felt myself struck, first of all, by the fact that it didn't seem to me that it had anything to do with how at least I was thinking It certainly had a lot to do with how I described how I was thinking in more formal context, but it didn't seem to me to have much to do about how what actually went on in the buzzing and blooming of one's mind. I certainly didn't want to say, oh, well, all these people believe in mental representations, and I don't, and I'm right, and they're all wrong. Rather, I thought, they're all seeing something that I don't see. So in 1999, I decided to do a literature search on, literature searches and search engines were relatively new, at least in my experience. And I did a literature search on mental representations. And I started to read all this stuff coming from the sciences. And at this point, it was less neuroscience. This was before the decade of the brain. There was all this stuff on various sciences. And it was I recognized the model they were using when they were talking about representations. And I recognized it from my days at Roman Catholic schools when we read enormous amount of Aquinas. And it was very much an Aristotelian Thomistic picture. There was a Society for Philosophy and Psychology meeting that I know you and I were at, both of us, and I remember we had a session on representation. And there was somebody, I think he was a neuroscientist, and he was talking about representations of sentences in the brain. And somebody said, oh, I'm so glad you're all talking about representation. And I remember asking him, I said, look, do you think that's because there's something in the brain that's about the sentence, or do you think that in some sense the sentence gets neurally realized in the brain? And he said, oh, it's the latter that I'm talking about. So this Thomistic Aristotelian idea that things can get realized in one's mind or brain was really a very, very widely spread in what was then called the cognitive sciences. And I wrote about a lot of this literature in a 2003 article that came out in Philosophical Psychology on mental representations.
Well, let me, you've mentioned Aristotle, and you contrast the view that you've briefly introduced with what you call a Fodorian view.
Yeah.
So this is a basic distinction that you draw in the beginning of the book, before you go into some historical, you know, Humean aspects behind it, and then go forward to its applications to the emotions and action and belief and so on. But to start out the initial chapters of the book, you draw this basic distinction, the Fodorian or received or standard view, in which mental representations stand in some sort of aboutness or intentional relation to the world, to what they're about. And then your alternative, what you alternatively call a sampling view, an Aristotelian view, that you just describe in terms of realizing, in some sense, the same thing. So maybe you could just summarize what these two different views are, what the important differences are between them.
Yes. Let me just be clear. I'm in a way asking that people really rethink this kind of material. I don't think that there are mental representations in the Fodorian sense. but let me try to contrast, give you some a sense of the contrast. There are a couple of sort of ways we can access what I think the fundamental contrast is in ordinary life. And one of the distinctions is the distinction between displaying and describing. So Aristotelian representations are much more on the displaying side, and Fodorian representations are much more on the describing side. And there's a great deal of difference between displaying and describing when we look at things like Tai Chi. I can pretty much do Tai Chi if I'm watching a video. I can do this, but it would be extremely difficult. I'm not using this as an argument against them, but rather just as a contrast. It'd be extremely difficult to learn Tai Chi from a manual with descriptions of the actions. Other examples, I could describe to you the taste of whiskey, or I could give you a sample of it. And that's another contrast between displaying or making available and describing. A second way of looking at it is to see that in some very general sense, I think that Aristotelian representations have a lot to do with similarity, and Fedorian representations have just about nothing to do with similarity, except, of course, it may in some strange cases that we could cook up. I'm trying to think, does that start to make it clearer?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm just, well, let's maybe by focusing on why you call it Aristotelian. Because Aristotle famously, you know, he had this view of perception, you know, leading to cognition. But, you know, perception, where the eye, you know, looking at a red object, for example, you know, takes on some intelligible form, right? Yeah. This is all based on his metaphysics of form and matter, but, you know, it takes on an intelligible form that is in some sense, just like is a sample of, you know, the sensible form. And so people have argued in that literature that Aristotle literally means that the eye, something in the eye becomes red. Of course, the redness there is the intelligible redness that is somehow the same as the sensible redness of the tomato. But it's not that the eye does something about the red. It is actually something of the same kind. So that's I take it why you call it Aristotelian to begin with.
Well, let me just say, Aristotle, I think there are probably different ways, but it is in the general Aristotelian gymnastic tradition important to distinguish between sensible forms and intelligible forms. And sensible forms are the sensory characteristics that are, forms can be realized in matter, and they can be multiply realized in matter. So you get patches of red all over the place. And you can also get the intelligible form, catness, for example, all over the place, including in cats and in your intellect. This idea that there's a very general idea of kind of re-realization. And so I think it's probably there before Aristotle, but it's certainly most clearly articulated first in Aristotle. And then it's picked up and really hotly, heavily described by Thomas. One of the important things that that both of them say, and it simply has to be true because we're not going to find cats inside you, that these forms, when they're realized in the sensory system or in the intellect, are realized in a different way and realized in a way that's appropriate to them. And there's been some discussion of whether that just doesn't make the account vacuous. And some people say, no, it isn't vacuous, because it occurs in a whole big theory, and other people say, well, yeah, that's about as vacuous as it can be, right? You get red in the brain, but not as, doesn't mean you're going to find something red in the brain, because red is realized in the brain in a way that's different, and that's appropriate to reds being realized in the brain. So it's a difficult view, and for this idea of realizing was why I started with Aristotle, but the view changes enormously according to the ontology you employ, and that's very, very important. So, for example, when we hit 20th and 21st century science, let me see. Are you losing me?
No.
Oh, good, because my computer is saying, you've got to enter your password again and stuff like that. It's unhappy that I'm not giving you pictures. So it said that in very fierce, broad type. Anyway, what the ontology is makes a huge difference. But there's a general idea of realizing it's there.
Well, maybe an example might. You mentioned cat, and this idea of something being realized in two different media it's not an odd one nowadays. So, for example, people will simulate or model a weather pattern,
yes,
on a computer. So you have a hurricane modeled on the computer, and then of course it's modeling something in the world. And on your view, it's not the and tell me if this is correct or not. The model is not about the hurricane. It is just another instance or realization, as you put it, of the same thing, some abstract pattern, I take it. You mentioned that these sample representations are somehow, empirically equivalent or formally equivalent patterns. So could you say something more about these patterns that make it the case that what is in the mind and what is outside the mind both realize the same formal pattern?
Yeah, I'm not sure I want to put much stress on formal patterns. It means that they can be described mathematically in the same way, and that's an empirical fact, that they can be described mathematically in the same way. I think one of the problems, in the book, that's basically all I said. And the reason why that was basically all I said is that, as far as I could see from the neuroscientists like Peter Diane, that's basically all he said. We've got these capacities for mathematically describing way in which stimulus impinges on the eye and the patterns of neural firing that result and the transformations of these neural firing. We've got this kind of mathematical capacity to, as it were, sort of see how this unfolds and see how, and which we can still take ourselves to be describing the same thing. What I've since discovered, and I don't know how I missed it, is that there is really an industry now, though it seems to be centered around a few people, one particularly in Cambridge, on representational similarity understood geometrically. And so there's an effort to look at how we could consider patterns the same. This is the same pattern, but transformed in certain ways. And unfortunately, I've just discovered it within the last month, and it is mathematically very difficult for me. But I can give you what I also discovered is where it came from, which was in the 1970s. And here's a statement by Tversky that gives you an idea of the kind of thing they're doing. He says, a new set theoretical approach to similarity is developed in which objects are represented as collections of features and similarity is described as a feature matching process. Specifically, a set of qualitative assumptions is shown to imply the contrast model, which expresses a similarity between objects as a linear combination of the measures of their common and distinctive features. Several predictions of the contrast model tested in studies of similarity with both semantic and perceptual stimuli. The model predicts behavior and so explains behavior. So the idea in both now that kind of approach is now taken from behavior to the neuroscience. And the idea is that we can look at patterns of spiking and we can talk about similarities and differences from the stimulus array. And that's an Aristotelian representation. When you go from a stimulus array to a pattern of neural firing, and you have the mathematical ability to talk about similarities and differences, and that is the core of your notion of representation, is similarities and differences.
Okay, so could you say something about how you motivate the Aristotelian view? Your core argument seems to be an argument more or less familiar from the mentor causation literature, the idea that somehow contents in the more traditional sense are causally irrelevant. Can you explain that?
Explain why I think they're causally irrelevant?
No, why? What motivates your alternative view?
It's that this is the view that's there in neuroscience, and the idea is that it is going to explain human cognition. So I think that's an important phenomenon. I think it may well explain human cognition, and it has, for me, really desirable implication. For example, if content is in the head, then what we think about as our mental life supervenes at least in part on stuff that isn't in the head, and in particular, it's got a very distinctive social factor to it. So for me, that's important. Somebody, I thought, so nice to see myself described in an article in Hypatia saying, oh, well, this is a neo-feminist materialism, which is, that says it's, the brain is very important, it's very materialist, but it also says, the social components are there not just as causes, but they're as constitutive of what content is. So I think there is semantic content, thank God, right? And it's in language. But what the base for the content that is correctly ascribed to ourselves goes far beyond what's in the brain.
Okay, well, there are people in the traditional, sort of intentional camp or aboutness camp, I suppose you might call them, who are also internalists about content.
Yes, most of them are. Well, many
are externalist or dual. Yeah. Dual factor theorists. So what would make your view a better alternative to, say, somebody who is who thinks that content is determined by, causal relationships or aboutness, or that there is aboutness, but who is an internalist about content?
Well, I'm actually not sure how I... Let me try this. What I wanted to look at is what empirically informed scientific view of the mind is.
Mm-hmm.
And there, when I see representations, I don't see aboutness or anything like semantic content. What I see is a dominant notion of similarity. And I see it in a way that it has to do with the realization of features. And it looks very Aristotelian to me. So I think that has a lot to recommend it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure quite what to think about the alternatives, except that I don't think that we have a coherent story of internal content. I was looking at Lewis Carroll's about The Hunting of the Snark, because I think mental representations, and we'll see this if we separately discuss historical work that I've been trying to do. Mm-hmm. But mental representations are a very recent invention. If you look at the Philosophical Index, I think there's something like 5 or 10 instances of mental representation until a year after Jerry Fodor's book, The Language of Thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think mental representations, as philosophers nowadays understand them, is a very recent invention. I think that it has enormous problems. And at the same time, even though it says it's doing what the neuroscientists are doing, it's not. There's this wonderful passage from Lewis Carroll's The Snark. The snark is a mythical beast. Mm-hmm. They thought it was thimbles. They sought it with care. They pursued it with forks and hoof. They threatened its life with a railway share. They charmed it with smiles and soup. Now, I don't want to say that that's my view of contemporary. It would be incredibly arrogant to say that. But I don't think that this other story works. Now, I was thinking that one should say something about this at some point. What my view is doing is it's really presenting a very different picture to the dominant one. I've heard Jesse Prinz, and I've talked some about this, and I've heard him come to a very similar view. And some people are very optimistic about this view. Bill Bechtel has been wonderfully supportive, for example. But something like this is very difficult. First of all, it's very difficult to ask people to rethink the whole field. It's very difficult to do it. And it's not very publishable. So I get... I've published two or three articles directly on this. Aristotelian representations show up. I sneak them in almost everything else I've published. Mm-hmm. People have asked for a work of mine, but you're not going to find anybody referring to them. And if I submit a thing about mental representation, say in Hume, then the referees really do not behave, often do not behave very well. To say the least.
Yeah.
So difficulty in publishing something that really does try to rethink the whole field.
I want to move to the Hume sections. Mm. But before I do that, I did want to just ask about the traditional view, people talk about satisfaction conditions or truth conditions, right, of belief. You know, desires are satisfied, beliefs are true or false. What sorts of conditions, obviously we do have, we have false beliefs and desires that are unsatisfied and so forth. You won't be using, if you use that language, it has to be interpreted some other way, or you use a different language. So how would you, in your framework, how would you talk about what other people talk about when they use the term truth conditions or satisfaction conditions?
Well, I think there are truth conditions and satisfaction conditions for beliefs, uh-huh. But I don't think beliefs are something in the head. I don't think anything in the brain has truth conditions or satisfaction conditions. Interestingly enough, people who've been Aristotelians, as I understand them, in particular Aristotle, Aquinas, and Hume Hume says ideas are neither true nor false. And one of the interesting things that Hume then does, because beliefs are lively ideas and beliefs are true or false, he's got a problem there. And I think Annette Bias has suggested that he's got a dual aspect theory, and it's both ideas and language. And that's in part what my solution is, that we do attribute beliefs to ourselves and to other people. They are true or false, and language makes a lot of this possible. But what we're not doing is describing states of the brain, which are true or false.
Okay.
Says, for example, and Aristotle says something very similar, an idea of red, right, copies the red. And if there isn't a red for it to copy, then it's not that it's a false idea of red. It's just not an idea of red at all.
So
a sample of something, if that thing doesn't really exist, then you can't have a sample of it.
Right. So then what is the relationship between the samples that are in the head and the beliefs that we ascribe that can be true or false?
Well, I mean, I think that's a I think actually that there isn't some natural kind like belief, that our belief descriptions do lots of different things, that they may place our actions in a particularly familiar context. And also the same with animals. We say the cat is scared. Trying to place it in its behavior in a particular pattern. That doesn't mean... So beliefs, ascriptions are often parts of explanations, making sense of things, setting them a certain pattern. Very often, what inside of us is causing that pattern is something that is really self-doctastic. Reed Montague has really wonderful work, I think, on this.
But actually, it sort of sounds a little bit Dennettian.
Yeah, I think it does, except that, it doesn't go along with Dennett, as I take him, to accept some of the standard ideas of what our ascriptions are doing, our cause and effect ascriptions. I don't think explanations of actions need be cause effect explanations, for example.
Okay, so you mentioned Hume before, and in the middle chapters of the book, you go into some Hume scholarship and present him as a sort of an Aristotelian, at least in some sense. Can you explain the Humean link there?
Well, Hume is an Aristotelian, I think.
Okay.
He does say ideas copy impressions, and they have all the same features except for force and vivacity. And that sounds like Aristotelian to me. There are a couple of reasons for bringing in the history of philosophy. One is that I think it is just false to think that there's some common notion of representation that has been used through the centuries, and we can look at Aristotle and say, oh, when Aristotle talks about representations, he's talking about the same thing as the 21st century analytic philosopher. I think that's just a wrong approach, and it's to be very, very interesting that this conviction has seized the historical, has really heavily influenced historical research, because when we went through the idea that all modern philosophers were really skeptics, and there was the hero of Wittgenstein who came and slayed them all with a private language argument, people started to say, hey, wait, we shouldn't be reading historical philosophers as though they're writing in the 21st century. But I think that has happened with representation. And so that's one of the things I wanted to try to bring out and to challenge. And so I looked. I think, for example, Pasnow, I hope I pronounced his name correctly, has some really bad criticisms of Aquinas. He thinks that Aquinas gets confused between the content of an idea or a mental state. And he thinks the sort of semantic features get treated in odd ways, and he doesn't understand. Anyway, I think maybe I should leave that for readers of the book to see. But that was one reason. The second reason was I wanted to display the extent to which this Aristotelian notion has been a notion in the history of philosophy, and discovering it in Hume was wonderful and something of a surprise, I must say. So that was another thing. And then a third thing is that I think Hume's argument, some of his arguments start to look really good. People think that they can just dismiss the argument against abstract ideas, because obviously we can have an abstract idea of piety, but in fact, or an abstract idea of a triangle. But in fact, if we think we have an abstract idea of a triangle, then we're not employing Hume's conception of an idea. And when we do look at his conception of the idea, the argument looks very much better. So I thought that was really kind of exciting. And then finally, Hume may be the first, but certainly he's a good example of somebody who sees that with the theory of ideas, you really do need language to add in essential features that you're not going to get simply from the theory of ideas. And that's a net bias insight.
Okay, so what could you say a bit more about that, about what language adds?
Well, I'm suddenly putting a blank on where Annette sees that he does this, mm-hmm. and it may be in the theory of ideas. So, yes, I think that's it. So though we don't have abstract ideas, we do have abstract terms. Mm-hmm. And so that's what makes it possible to do all sorts of things that we couldn't do if we were tied down completely to very specific ideas. Then there are other problems that he has, that he doesn't bring language in particularly, but he could. And I think the belief one is one of them, where beliefs are these ideas that are neither true nor false. Sorry, ideas are neither true nor false, but beliefs are vivid ideas, and they are true or false. Mm-hmm. That's a huge problem. So you could distinguish between ideas in the mind and belief ascriptions.
So let me, you mentioned, you know, the mental representations and ideas have, you know, changed throughout history, and there's different sorts throughout history.
There are different sorts throughout history. There are different ontologies.
Right.
I think here's something that I should mention. Look at the Oxford English Dictionary at the word representation. There's very little unity to it. But there's not a hint of anything like content as we understand it today. There are all sorts of examples from throughout the history of English, and nothing like what we understand it to mean today. The possible exception is, if I'm remembering correctly, it's been years since I've looked at it, possible exception is that you might represent somebody in a bad light. And that starts to look a little bit more close to a kind of content, maybe, or something like
right.
that.
Could you, you said at the very beginning, and you say this throughout the book, that the view that you're presenting, the alternative, is one that is, you know, found, you know, in the relevant sciences itself, in cognitive neuroscience. Could you maybe give a good example of a theorist that is, you know, that where your sample view actually, you know, appears to be the one that's being used?
There's certainly a whole area where it's just very, very obvious. But let me mention that if you look up, if you Google representation, similarity, and geometry, you're going to find a whole lot of people who are trying this project of seeing patterns of neural excitation in terms of geometrically describable similarities and differences. But the area where this seems to be completely clear is one, in fact, in which one of its main proponents wrote me. I had snuck in representations and introduction to a journal I was editing, and Marco Iacoboni wrote and said, he said, this is the first time I've seen it. This is representation as we've been using it. And a lot of his work at the time was mirror neurons. And the idea that when I watch somebody perform an action, I get realized in me the motor program for performing that action.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also that I can't remember if he was then writing about emotions, but plenty of people have, that when I see somebody who's sad, I feel sad. And that is, I get an instance of that pattern of, that unfortunate pattern in my brain. And I feel the same thing. So that kind of case, where the patterns realized in the brain are the same as one, you don't need fancy mathematics to understand that. That's just that's common experience, and I think a very interesting underlying explanation. Well, we feel sad because our brains are resonating in such a way that we're now in the same state.
Well, you just mentioned, you know, action and emotion, and one of the interesting things you do at, you know, toward the end of the book, after discussing the, you know, the Humean historical roots, is to look at particular cases or applications, you know, in particular areas of mental, particular kinds of mental phenomena, you know, vision, action, emotions, and belief. And I thought it would be a good idea to look at some of those aspects.
Uh-huh.
So in terms of vision, perhaps, maybe you can, to start with that, how your theory informs theories of vision.
Yes. I think with... I'm trying to remember, when I was writing on vision, I was starting to pick up reasons for rejecting a kind of intentionist view. That is, that when I open my eyes, what I receive is a Fodorian representation of the environment around me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't get that. I think it's been known for some time that the reaction I have is at best very gappy, incomplete, picture, I suppose one might say, of elements in my environment. And what interested me in that chapter was really, what is the sort, because we don't describe ourselves that way at all. We describe ourselves in terms of having really a very complete view of the world around us. And in fact, we tend to believe we have this very complete view of the world around us. And the book, The Invisible Gorilla, which I hope most people know about, and if you don't know about it.
Oh, Daniel Simon.
You must go get it. What happens is that juries, for example, are very fierce with people who claim they didn't see something. And yet, of course, we often don't see something. I have this terrible trouble with keys and glasses. And you can be looking at something and simply not see it. And that's because seeing depends an awful lot on the direction of attention, for example. And attention is very, very limited. But I must say right now, I don't know how to describe visual experience in general. That is, I don't think we have the Fodorian representations we think we have. And I have a pretty good idea of how we can describe it neurally. But I don't have an answer to the problem of qualia. And I wish I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about you also find a connection between your view and Barsalo's theory of perceptual symbol systems?
Yeah.
Could you go into this connection?
Sure. That was, to me, completely amazing to read him and have him say, see him say, well, when we remember something, what we're doing is we're getting a sort of copy of the original experience, and it has the same features. I mean, it's really a very, very human kind of view. But he does talk in terms of thinking, in terms of a manipulation of tokens that copy our experience. It's not about our experience,
mm-hmm.
but rather copies the experience.
Or it's another exemplar of it, or sample?
Well, it has, it's like the Tversky thing. It has, he is going to say, a number of the same features. But we're going to have to understand same features. And I don't think he does this. We're going to have to understand it a bit in a guarded way, because, of course, they aren't they don't have the vividness of actual sensory experience. They're copies of sensory experiences. They have many of the same features, but in a slightly different way. I'm trying to think. I probably have some also around here. Let me see if I can just put... my hands on a bit of it. It's in chapter 7, which is entitled Thought. Mm-hmm. Here he says, the convergent zone architecture has the functional ability to reenact sensory, motor, and introspective states. Once conjunctive neurons in convergence zone capture a pattern of activation in a feature area, these neurons can later reinstantiate the pattern in the absence of bottom-up stimulation. Mm-hmm. During the recollection of a perceived object, for example, conjunctive neurons reenact the sensory, motor, and introspective states that were active while processing it originally. So it's reenactment. However, at least some semblance of the original state is partly reinstantiated. So that's not an appeal to content at all. It's an appeal to similarity, a rather guarded one.
Let me ask about, you mentioned also the emotions, and you have a chapter or two chapters, actually, I think, on how your view informs our theorizing about the emotions. And one of the things you argue is that they like beliefs, I think you mentioned, are not a natural kind.
Yeah.
Can you explain how your view of representation intersects with theories of the emotions?
Well, emotions are states, right? Thinking about emotions is probably going to involve either a Barcelou type of thing, a recalling, or it's going to, in which case it's going to involve an Aristotelian representation, or it may be a much more conceptual episode, in which case I do think language is this amazing code for us, and we can internalize it. And a lot of our conceptualization is in terms of the shared language. That's for me a very important part of vision, is that a lot of the content of vision that we ascribe to ourselves is actually derived from this shared language. And a lot of the content of emotion certainly can be. A lot of what we understand about emotion can be highly conceptualized. I thought Aristotelian representations are certainly important when we understand and think about understanding other people. And so that was one major role they play in with emotions. But I was also interested in this idea that a lot of the things that we theorize about are actually not natural kinds in any robust way. And we're probably not going to get good empirical generalizations about that. And my thought that is the case with emotions. It's hardly original. Paul Griffiths argued it. Unfortunately, I think overly provocatively denying that there were emotions at first. Mm-hmm. He sees that we do have very primitive reactions, but we also have reactions that parable literature says that are actually very social. And so what we feel when we are angry may depend on our social setting. They're scaffolded by society is one of the things that said. So, for example, I think even it's been claimed that pain is much worse if you're around other people, with the idea that it then transforms from that initial reaction into cries for help and assistance and stuff like that.
Hmm. Well, there's a couple questions. We're getting close to the end, so I want to make sure I get everything in that I'd like to. One question is about the role of embodiment, which we haven't talked about at all, but it does definitely come up throughout the book. And you mention some of Al the Noy's work. So that was one issue I did want to get to, is how how your theory intersects with recent work on the embodiment of thought and embodied cognition.
Yeah, that's really interesting. In fact, there's a volume coming out. I'm writing a paper for it now with Dan Hooter, I believe, one of the editors, and certainly somebody in the embodied cognition group. Here's a major contribution I wanted my work to do. People who are in the embodied cognition camp very, very often are very hostile to anything like internal representations. And I think that they're right to be hostile to internal Dorian representations. But I don't think that's what neuroscience is about. And so I think they miss out on a huge amount of neuroscience. And Al the Noy is somebody for whom I would say that is the case. And I can use a specific example that I used in the book. I'd forgotten exactly when his first book on perception came out, but it may have been something like 2004. And by 2000, it is accepted by vision scientists as absolutely clear. What we do is we have these the products of these intervals, and saccades are rapid eye movements, and we have the products of the intervals between saccades. And this is actually gives us something which we might even count as a kind of jerky series of rapid takes on the environment. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't experience ourselves as it were walking through the world with a handheld camera. But it's jerking around. So how do we get from the jerky takes to the smooth running of the horse across the meadow, say? Mm-hmm. Well, Alpha Noyes makes no reference to the neuroscience and says, well, we have all this knowledge of how these animals behave and what they're like, and basically we use it to fill in not the perceptual experience, but rather a sort of our vivid beliefs about the perceptual experience. But in, let me see, I think it was 2008, there was publication of Vision Science, and suddenly the whole vision science explodes with alternative explanations, neural explanations of how we go from a series of jerky takes to the smooth transition object. And the embodied theorists can't appeal to that. And I think that's a terrible loss. Now, one intriguing hypothesis that's developed by a group of scientists, including perhaps my closest friend here at U of H, Haluk Ogman, claims that there is, as it were, a second level of processing that puts the jerky takes together. And while the earlier jerky takes are retinotopic, that is, their space maps on to the retina, the later is not retinotopic. And so we, as it were, put together in the temporal lobe, we put the jerky takes together to create the experience of a smoothly moving object. And one of the most interesting things about this is that the smooth moving object appears to move through Einsteinian space, while the retinotopic objects are in Newtonian space. And so there are predictable distortions in our experience of the smoothly moving object from the Newtonian point of view. And but honestly, I've forgotten what it is. Whether it seems to get bigger as it goes faster or smaller, I think it gets bigger as it goes faster, something like that. And the embodied theorists who are avoiding internal representations can't deal with that, whereas I want to say, hey, look, you don't need to, you can do neuroscience without putting all this content in the head. You can do it by using Aristotelian representations, which is what the scientists are doing. One of the things about the Aristotelian representations that scientists do, and that's very important for them, is that you've got a kind of double inference. You can infer from the stimulus to the representation. You can infer from the representation to the stimulus. And that's because of their sharing of properties. And so, I mean, that's a very, very standard move. Mind you, the inferences can be extremely complicated, highly mathematical inferences. But I've heard people say, and so now you know it really is a representation because we can make this double inference.
So let me, there's one question that you've mentioned a couple times, public language, and it you didn't, at least I didn't pick up an emphasis on that aspect in the book itself, although it is, it certainly does come up there.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if you might, you know, sort of as a last pass at the book, explain a bit more about the role of public language. You know, because, you know, you're eschewing a language of thought, right? And of course, Fodor famously argued that, you know, you need that private language to have the public language. Obviously you won't buy that argument, but could you, rather than argue against him, just how do you see public language filling out the account that you're giving of the mental representations?
Oh, that's really chapter 7, and it comes after this thing on Barstow. And let me say, first of all, I say pretty carefully and guardedly that you're not going to get in a chapter of a book a whole account of human thought, but that what I wanted to do is to point to two theorists who were developing theories that could solve some of the problems I had. And the second one was Dehaene and his account of mathematical ability. And for him, we have a kind of primitive, as you may know, we have a kind of primitive numerical line that underlies a very primitive mathematical abilities that we share with the brutes. And even, indeed, it turns out we share with bees. Bees can count, turns out. And what distinguishes us from these others, besides very obvious things, we're not bees, but is that we have the language. And it's the language that enables us to develop the mathematical, we have a language code. And it has, let's see, it has several aspects to it, one of which is visual and one of which is linguistic. In a very literal sense. And so for him, mathematics is a combination of, or requires, a shared code. We learn it from other people, and we can internalize it. And it's got these various aspects, and it's what makes mathematics possible. And I took that to be a model of how I could approach thought that certainly doesn't seem to be Aristotelian. It's not clear how in Aristotelian terms you would get anything like productivity, compositionality,
right,
for example. So one thing one could say is, well, we have this public language that has these features, and we can internalize that code. And that's what we're doing with some, and maybe for a significant part, of our thought. But this thing, I mean, it's, as it were, it would be simple, and I don't think it's quite this simple, to say, well, what we really have here are Kahneman's system one, which is Aristotelian, and system two, which is this internalized code. But a lot of our thought is system one, and a lot of it is independent of this internalized code. And that's true, of course, for mathematical thought, that we are often, in the case of making fairly primitive estimates about quantity, that if Dehaene is right, is language independent. So anyway, we have a code and we internalize it. A thing I liked about it that obviously has some differences from Fodor, and one of them is that it comes from the outside. And so it does seem to me that Fodor is weak on explaining how it is that we manage to understand each other. I think it's controversial how well we do really understand each other. I don't think we do understand each other terribly well, but we're pretty good at understanding each other's speech. And one explanation would be, well, we're biologically similar, it comes from the inside. But another explanation would be that a lot of it comes from the outside.
Hmm. Well, I think we are out of time. So just to wrap up, can you say something about your next project, where you're going from here? Are you building on this book, or have you turned to other topics entirely?
I have three sorts of areas in which I work. One is cognitive. I probably should call it neurophilosophy. The second is history of philosophy. And the third, of course, which is very important to me, is feminist philosophy. You'll know that I blog on feministphilosophers.wordpress.com, and there's an enormous amount of things we need to think about. I think they're really interesting questions coming, and we're going to have a diversity in philosophy conference in at the end of May. In fact, you're on the program committee, as you know. And one of the things we're going to be looking at is how do you revise and challenge the canon? And you may understand that with my work, I can construct a lot. In fact, I did. I really hit the ceiling when this happened. I can construct a logically valid refutation, and somebody just looks at it and says, oh, I don't think he needs to be bothered about this. And that's because there is this informal canon and this informal agreement. And if you step outside that sort of those boundaries, then you may not be heard at all. Or even logically valid stuff gets just dismissed as not worth bothering about. So that's a huge problem, I think, for feminist philosophy, and that's something I want to work on. With the neurophilosophy, I really need to look much more, and I think this discussion has made me aware of it, even more, much more, at how similarity is getting used. And I just feel rather blessed having discovered this work in representation of similarity and the use of geometry to articulate a notion of similarity among neural firing patterns. And the history of philosophy, I would really like to write more about Hume and skepticism. So there are a couple of areas I'm looking at.
Great. Well, we are out of time at this point, so I wanted to thank you for an illuminating conversation about your new book.
Yeah, thank you. I learned a lot from your questions, and I am actually grateful.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Anne Japp Jacobson, Professor of Philosophy and Electrical and Computer Engineering at the University of Houston. We've been talking about her new book, Keeping the World in Mind, just out from Palgrave Macmillan. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.